May I please the court? James Hardy, attorney number 38173. I am a public defender and I represent Joe Dominguez. I intend to focus on the plea agreement issues and to save 5 minutes for rebuttal. Where a pure charge bargain is concerned, a judge's acceptance of a guilty plea and plea agreement cannot be rescinded absent a compelling justification or change in circumstances. In this case, the second judge erred and violated due process when he sua sponte reversed the first judge's acceptance of Mr. Dominguez's guilty plea and the plea agreement. The second judge lacked legal authority to reject the plea agreement, violated the separation of powers, and abused his discretion. The agreement was a pure charge bargain with no sentencing concessions. Judge Bachman's actions at the first hearing here demonstrated acceptance of the agreement. He granted the prosecution leave to amend the charges, accepted Mr. Dominguez's guilty plea, and was ready for immediate sentencing. Mr. Dominguez subsequently relied on the agreement, committed no breach or fraud, and the prosecution did not ask to withdraw from the deal. Now, in terms of the court's legal authority here, it's framed by due process and considerations of fairness to the defendant, going back to cases like Santabello and then Fisher and the Colorado courts. And due process and fairness to the defendant incorporate contract principles, mutual acceptance, detrimental reliance, and those are very much in play in this case. Mr. Dominguez relied on the first judge's acceptance of a plea agreement by participating in a pre-sentence report interview and by making statements at what was thought to be a sentencing hearing in front of the second judge in the context of sentencing. It was at that point that the second judge at this was supposed to be a sentencing hearing turned the hearing around and began intimating that he was going to reject Mr. Dominguez's plea. Mr. Dominguez has not committed breach or fraud. The pre-sentence report showed that Mr. Dominguez had the two prior felonies that had been represented that he would have at the first hearing before Judge Bachman. And the only change in circumstances here was the identity of the judge at the sentencing hearing. Clearly, that would be an arbitrary reason to reject the plea agreement. Moreover, the second judge at the sentencing hearing lacked authority under Rule 11 to compel Mr. Dominguez to withdraw his guilty plea. As far as that goes, the court essentially lacked jurisdiction to do so. Mr. Dominguez had no choice in this matter because this was, again, a pure charge bargain. The only consideration for the plea bargain here was the dropping of the three original charges for guilty plea to the fourth added misdemeanor charge. So the only result of the second judge's rejection of the plea agreement here would have been to withdraw the plea agreement against Mr. Dominguez's will, the legal plea.
What was the purpose of the pre-sentence investigation or the pre-sentence report, given the fact that if you say everything was said and done, why was there a need for a pre-sentence report? I couldn't understand that.
I understand it from the transcript. Your Honor, the record would strongly indicate that the only purpose of that pre-sentence report was to confirm that Mr. Dominguez had those two prior felonies. It's pretty clear from what the prosecutor says in that first hearing when the judge says, I assume we're moving to immediate sentencing here. The prosecutor says, well, actually, we'd like a pre-sentence report to confirm, I may not be quoting this exactly, but to confirm that that he has two prior felonies. And in that case, he would be probation ineligible. The court at that point says, basically re-advises Mr. Dominguez, says, Mr. Dominguez, do you understand that if the pre-sentence report comes back the way we expect it to, you're going to be probation ineligible and you will receive 3 to 12 months in jail.
What do you think the judge's position was before the prosecutor stood up and said that? Because he said, I'm ready to proceed. Judge Bachman seemed to be ready to proceed the sentencing right then and there. I can't tell whether he knew or didn't know, or the defendant conceded that he had these previous convictions which made him probation ineligible. I'm not sure what would have happened if they had proceeded the sentencing.
It certainly appears to me that Mr. Dominguez, he doesn't speak out when the prosecutor says that you know, we believe he has two prior felonies. And that information, especially considering the nature of the criminal history here, because one was an old case from California from the mid-90s, and then one was, I think, from the mid-2000s, a case from Nevada. So those might not have been things that are right at the prosecutor's fingertips. So it does appear that Mr. Dominguez and the prosecution had some conversations about this, and Mr. Dominguez was probably aware that he was going to be subject to 3 to 12 months in jail with no probation option. You know, in fact, he doesn't waiver as far as transcript reads when the court re-advises him and says, you know, you're going to be probation ineligible if this comes back the way we expect it to. Are you okay with that? And he's mm-hmm. on board, doesn't change the position one bit.
Mr. Hardy, what is the standard of review for this issue that you're raising?
Well, I would, the first two parts of the issue, I would say, are de novo review, Judge Hoffman. It's a question of law as to whether or not the second judge had legal authority at all to reject the plea agreement. Separation of powers, again, would be de novo review. It's a question of law. I think all the cases, or, you know, the large majority of cases in Colorado that look at that a separation of powers violation have applied de novo review. So, that is what I think the standard review is. On the third part, if we were to even get there, it would be an abuse of discretion standard.
The Attorney General says that we should review for plain error because there was no objection in the trial court to the second judge's saying that he wasn't going to accept the plea that had been agreed to before Judge Bachman. What is your response to that?
Well, I mean, there's two parts to that. I mean, I would strongly disagree that the issue hasn't been preserved. Mr. Dominguez and the prosecution entered a written plea agreement, which is in the record. The prosecution filed a motion for leave to amend the charges, which the court acknowledged and granted, or granted leave to amend the charges at the first hearing. Mr. Dominguez pleaded guilty. The court found it was voluntary, knowing, and intelligent twice, actually, at that first hearing. And when the sentencing hearing turns towards the second judge considering rejection of the plea agreement, Mr. Dominguez's counsel, you know, disagrees with the court at several points, disagrees with the court's, you know, seeming intent to reject the plea agreement and also the court's interpretation of facts in the pre-sentence report. So I don't think Mr. Dominguez could have made it much more clear that he objected to this action. Now, in terms of, you know, the harm, I do not think it's plain error review, but I almost think it's not a big question here. I mean, clearly Mr. Dominguez, no matter how you look at it, was harmed by the rejection of his plea agreement, where he would have ended up with a misdemeanor conviction, and instead he was forced to go to trial and end up with a felony conviction. You know, turning to separation of powers quickly, I would just again emphasize that what we're looking at is it was a pure charge bargain. There were no sentencing concessions in the case. And, you know, I cited in back in June, I believe, a case came out from our Supreme Court, Storley, it's called, which is a separation of powers case dealing with the prosecution's discretion to charge and the court's, you know, what kind of discretion the court has to reject the prosecution's desire to dismiss a charge. And I think that provides us some guidance here, where we have a pure charge bargain, where the only consideration is dismissal of criminal charges. And what, you know, what Storley says is that the court has narrow discretion to tread on the prosecution in terms of charging decisions, including dismissal of criminal charges. You know, it's only if the prosecution is clearly and convincingly not acting in the community or the defendant's best interest that the court can reject the prosecution's intent to dismiss charges. Unless the court has further questions at this point, I'd just like to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Thank you. You have a little more than 5.5 minutes left.
May it please the court, good morning. John First for the people. Trial courts have discretion to accept or reject a plea agreement, and courts have given two reasons for that. One is that there's no absolute right to plead guilty, and the second is that an agreement has no constitutional significance until the court accepts the agreement. Question here is whether the court, in accepting the guilty plea, bound itself to accept the plea agreement. Of course, our answer is no. And this derives from the statute in the rule, 16.7302, that says that the judge in every case should exercise independent judgment. Rule 11 also reiterates that, incorporates that rule. Darlington says the same thing. It says the court is to give the plea agreement due consideration before reaching a decision on whether to grant a charging or sentencing concessions. Judge Richmond, you asked the point of the pre-sentence report. Well, in every case, it gives the court the information necessary to make the consideration whether to accept or reject the plea. The reality is that...
The judge said, I accept the plea, and only later did it come up, a few lines later did it come up, that there was a request by the prosecution for pre-sentencing. Judge Bachman seemed ready to sentence him right away.
Judge, you are correct. The court said, Judge Bachman said, I will accept the plea, not the agreement, the plea. And that's the whole distinction here, the difference between accepting the plea and accepting the plea agreement. And the judge said, I assume we're proceeding to sentencing. What we're at, the defendant is asking you to find evidence in the record that the court bound itself to the agreement based on how we interpret what Judge Bachman said. That just doesn't strike us as the kind of explicit, affirmative kind of evidence that reflects the indication by the court that it wanted to be bound by the agreement. The court, in other words, is asking, what's next? That's all we're giving. I think that's reasonable an interpretation of what the court was saying yesterday.
At least in the defendant's mind, isn't the agreement to plead guilty contingent upon the other provisions of the plea agreement? Isn't that our expectation?
If
you're making it seem as if there are two different things, that there's a you can agree to plead guilty, fine, but whatever concessions have been made to you, but nobody cares, is basically what I'm hearing.
Well, it's not that nobody cares, Your Honor, it's just that ultimately the judge has to have, the judge has to be able to exercise its independent judgment. I mean, if otherwise, the judge is always going to be bound. I mean, the general rule in reality is that until we get to sentencing, the court can have this information through primarily the pre-sentence report. Only then can the judge make a considered determination on whether to accept the agreement. They don't have the pre-sentencing information. I mean, this plea progressed as the typical plea does.
But the,
they didn't, I mean, this couldn't have been more than 5 minutes.
But the agreement, as you describe it, did contain any sentencing concessions, correct? Counsel for the defendant says he called it a charge plea or charge agreement or something.
Put in the charge bargain.
Yes. Charge bargain. So once the court said, I accept that your plea guilty, there was no other element in the agreement that had to be accepted by the court, was there? In other words, it wasn't, and I will accept the sentence as well, because there was no sentence bargaining.
It had the discretion whether or not to ultimately honor the charge bargain just because it accepted the plea. I mean, the prosecution's part of the bargain was to ask the court to dismiss the felony menace charge. I mean, that's as, you know. Judge, if you're right, then again, the court has no discretion, cannot exercise independent judgment at the point of whether to accept the agreement at sentencing.
What?
I mean, otherwise, it's always bound by, and then that kind of categorical view of the situation would certainly intrude on the prosecution's ability, how they charge, how they enter into agreements. If merely accepting the, if accepting the plea is accepting every charge bargain, then the prosecution is, then there might be a separation.
Mr. First, I'm not sure I follow your reasoning, because I would think that in a case where there's a charge bargain, in any case, the trial court could say, well, at this point, the plea agreement or the plea sounds okay to me, but I'm not going to approve it until I see the pre-sentence report. That would retain discretion in the trial court to approve the plea bargain until after the pre-sentence report has been written.
Well, Judge, I think underlying that is an assumption that the court is bound at the providency hearing. I think the assumption should be the other way, and that we assume, unless the record indicates otherwise, it's a tentatively accepted agreement, that any agreement is tentative. And I think Roy demonstrates the exception. Roy shows that the record affirmatively showed that the court expressly agreed to a proposed sentence concession before the defendant pled guilty. The defendant had no criminal record. Now, granted, it's a sentence concession, not a charge bargain. Nonetheless, we have affirmative, the court affirmatively agreeing to accept it, agreeing to be bound, and did that before the defendant pled guilty. The defendant pled guilty based on the court's representation that it would accept the agreement. As it turned out, it didn't have a record, but for other reasons, the court rejected, based on other information that came up. A division of this court viewed the trial court's action as an unqualified approval subject to modification, only in the presence of criminal history. That's the exception. What happened here is the way pleas generally progress. And
what made the plea here a qualified acceptance in your view?
Again, because nothing was affirmatively put on the record to indicate that the court was going to be bound by the agreement. It's our position that the general rule is that unless the record reflects otherwise, any acceptance has to be tentative, presumed to be tentative, in order for the court to be able to exercise its independent judgment at the time of sentencing.
In your view, what would Judge Bachman have to have said additionally to have unequivocally accepted the plea agreement?
I will unequivocally accept this plea agreement. I mean, words to that effect. We don't have that here. It's just, as far as Judge Bachman was concerned, we got a plea to a misdemeanor here. We're pleading it down. What's next?
Would you agree that the charges had to be dropped at that point, the other charges? You're not saying he just pled guilty to the misdemeanor, the other charges could still stay there. That certainly wasn't the agreement.
At the point that the judge accepts the agreement of sentencing, then the judge can dismiss. It's still tentative at that point. The plea has to, it's only until sentencing, and the judge accepts the agreement, proceeds with sentencing, that the plea continues to be accepted.
Mr. First, what's the basis for your contention that there's a distinction between a plea and a plea agreement? I'm not sure I understand that.
Well, I mean, a guilty plea is just is the defendant entering his position, the plea that he's willing to give to any particular charge. I mean, I guess I don't understand.
Well,
as opposed to agreement, which encompasses more than just the plea, it encompasses obligations by the prosecution as well.
Well, wasn't there a written plea agreement here that was tendered to the court?
Of course. I don't remember if there's a written plea agreement, so I can't.
Well, whether it was written or oral, I mean, there was apparently an agreement that certain charges would be dropped and that the defendant would plead guilty to a misdemeanor. Do you agree with that?
That was the agreement.
Right. So again, I would ask, what's the difference, in your view, between a plea and a plea agreement? If you just said that there was an agreement, then I'm still puzzled by what your position is.
Because I'm not sure how to answer, Your Honor, because the agreement involves, the plea is just from the defendant. The agreement involves other parties, involves the prosecution, involves the court's acceptance. I mean, it's still tentative. The court, again, going back to the principle, the court is not obligated to, a defendant has no absolute right to get to plead guilty, and the court is not necessarily bound to accept it. Otherwise, again, the court has no independent judgment.
Well, is it your position that this plea or plea agreement was expressly subject to the obtaining of a pre-sentence investigation, a pre-sentence report?
I don't know that the plea written or oral said it was subject to a pre-sentence report. That's just part of the process in order that the court can be informed to make a considered determination on how to sentence and whether to accept the agreement. That's just part of the process.
Because if it wasn't subject to the pre-sentence report and that wasn't part of the agreement, it seems like once the judge said, I accept the plea or the agreement, that would have ended the situation. He was ready. He said, I am ready. I assume we're proceeding to immediate sentencing. I don't think the judge needed a pre-sentence report. I mean, isn't that what's different between this case and Roy? And Roy, they were anticipating some sentencing information. It turned out it didn't come out to whatever people thought it might be, and the judge changed his mind anyway. This seems to be even a stronger case for the defendant, where there was no expectation whatsoever about pre-sentencing report until the prosecutor spontaneously asked for one.
Well, pre-sentence reports, it's like making mandatory parole part of the sentence. I mean, it can be done, but the statute requires a pre-sentence report. It can be waived, but pre-sentence, you can't, pre-sentence report just, it was not a term of this agreement, let's say that. I mean, as I understand it, in my recollection of the record, there wasn't anything affirmative about whether or not a pre-sentence report is a term of the agreement.
And Mr. Frisk, from my understanding of what happened, after Judge Bachman accepted the plea or the plea agreement, however you choose to describe it, and there was a discussion that the defendant was not eligible for probation, and the prosecutor said the sentence would be 3 months to 12 months in prison, or could be 3 months to 12 months in prison. So it seems to me that in those circumstances, that the pre-sentence report was not just window dressing, it would have an impact on what the ultimate sentence would be.
Well, window dressing or not, it was part of the process.
Yes, I agree with that. But by the same token, if Judge Bachman thought it was inappropriate that the plea agreement that had been entered into between the prosecution and the defendant was unacceptable, Judge Bachman could have said, I'm not going to accept this plea agreement because I think a jury should decide what happened here.
The court didn't have that information. It wasn't until sentencing that the parties went back and forth that in an attempt to mitigate, the defendant said, I didn't do anything wrong. Defense counsel gets up there, we have a possible Fourth Amendment violation. None of this happened at the probability hearing. This is the kind of thing that it comes out of sentencing, is meant to come out of sentencing. That's what the process is. Court at the probability hearing doesn't have the information. Should there be a pre-sentence report done before the defendant pleads guilty? What if they go into the plea hearing and the defense says, I don't want to plead guilty? You've got this inefficient ordering of a pre-sentence report, when it's not the way it works, Judge, and it's not semantics whether it's a plea or plea agreement. That's the whole distinction in this case. And all the defendant did at the probability hearing was enter his plea. It wasn't until the sentencing hearing that the viability of the plea agreement and the question of whether the court would accept it was in play. Unless the court has further questions, I ask them. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
touch on a few things that my adversary here had to say. First, on the record, there is a written request to plead guilty. It's about 6 to 8 pages, lots of text there. My recollection, I didn't have time to patient the whole thing, you know, in these last few minutes, but my recollection is there's no mention of a pre-sentence report. There's also a document, signed by both the prosecution and Mr. Dominguez, which is headed, captioned, plea agreement of the parties. And what that document reads, in substance, actually literally, is that counts 1 through 3, the original counts, will be dismissed if the guilty plea is accepted. Guilty plea. So even under Mr. First's reading of the events here, when the guilty plea was accepted, those counts were dismissed. I mean, in the first hearing, Judge Bachman granted leave to amend that fourth count on the record. So those counts were dismissed by the agreement of the parties. In terms of, you know, retaining discretion for the trial court judge, Judge Bachman exercises discretion at that first hearing. You know, in terms of, you know, why would they, at the point where the prosecution says we might want a PSR here, why potentially would everyone concerned be willing to go forward with that instead of immediate sentencing? Well, one answer to that is leniency. I mean, it could have been the case that Mr. Dominguez didn't actually have 2 prior felonies on his record and that he would have been probation eligible. Everybody assumed that, and it turned out to be the case, but PSR could have come out otherwise. Also, as one of your honors mentioned, you know, Mr. Dominguez had an opportunity, once the plea agreement had been accepted, to participate with the probation officer in the PSR, you know, give his side of the story, give some background to try to mitigate and get a lower sentence within that 3 to 12 month range. You know, further, in terms of at the first hearing, whether or not this was like a deferral situation, you know, Judge, if that was the situation, Judge Bachman could very well have said, I'm going to defer my ruling until we have the PSR, which he requested. He didn't do that. And then subsequent to that, all the parties, including Judge Bachman at that hearing, conducted themselves as if this plea agreement could have been accepted. Unless the court has questions, I would ask that the court specifically enforce the plea agreement, or alternatively, if the court does not go that route, reverse Mr. Dominguez's convictions under the trial issues in the briefs. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments and your briefing. We appreciate them very much. The case will now stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes.